Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1049, interview number 18 with Jim DiGiacomo about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on Martin Luther King's birthday, January 15th of the year 2019. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airways Jim DiGiacomo, the author of, among other titles, The Triumphal Destiny Betrayed, which will be the focal point of our broadcast today. Jim, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Okay, nice to be here, Dave.
We have been talking about Jim Garrison's trial of Clay Shaw, and I think nothing illustrates the nature of American political process, the perversion of legal reality, and really the essence of not only the squashing of Jim Garrison's investigation, but the essence of the perversion of American political process, better than what happened with Regis Kennedy. First, tell us, who was Regis Kennedy?
Regis Kennedy was one of the two leading FBI agents on the Cuban exile beat in New Orleans, all right? The other one being Warren DeBries. The reason Kennedy and DeBries were assigned that is because they spoke Spanish. All right. So those two guys, because of their bilingual skills, had very good relations and very good intel on what was going on in the Cuban exile community in New Orleans. And there was a lot going on because once you got out of Florida, all right, heading west, New Orleans was the next big city that the CIA dumped a lot of these Cuban exiles into. All right. And they were preparing for things like, of course, the Bay of Pigs invasion and also the Operation Mongoose. So they were used in those kind of paramilitary operations, and Regis Kennedy was very knowledgeable about that stuff. And, in fact, there was more than one credible report that Kennedy was in Guy Bannister's office. And he was also a member of the Friends of Democratic Cuba. He was part of that organizing committee. So Regis Kennedy knew which way was up, okay, when you're talking about the Cuban exile community in New Orleans.
Before we actually get to what happened in his testimony in the trial, in an earlier reference to him, I opined, and you agreed, that he was, to make things somewhat simple, one of the good guys whose goodness was attenuated in the trial.
I think in the sense that he would have been a very good witness, you know, for what Garrison was trying to show. I don't think there's any doubt that he would have been a very good and a very credible, delivered very good and credible testimony, you know, about what the heck was going on down there.
And when he actually was called to testify in the trial, some interesting things happened. Tell us about Regis Kennedy's testimony in the trial and what happened to it.
Well, to say that this was interesting is probably a monumental kind of understatement, all right, because Garrison needed somebody to go ahead and testify about the official inquiry into the JFK case as far as New Orleans went, all right? And so he decided to call Regis Kennedy, all right? Now, even before Kennedy took the stand, all right, even before he took the stand, there had been talk between Garrison's office and the Justice Department, all right? And he was only allowed to ask Kennedy about Dean Andrews and his consequent search for Clay Bertrand, all right? Now, there's a heck of a lot else that Kennedy could have testified to credibly, but by prearrangement with the Justice Department, those were the only things that he could testify about. All right. Now, so once he got on the stand, all right, the Garrison's attorney, Jim Alcock, asked him if he was involved with the investigation into President Kennedy's death prior to his interview with Dean Andrews, all right, which I believe was on the 24th. Okay. All right. Kennedy balked at answering the question, and then he conferred with the Justice Department aide in the court at that time, who was a guy named Harry Connick Sr., which we'll have a lot more to say about that later in the series.
By the way, his son, Harry Connick Jr., is a fairly well-known singer. Go ahead, Jim.
Correct. All right. Now, Connick then, after he conferred with Kennedy refused to answer the question. All right? So then Alcock objected. The trial was stopped. The jury was led back into their chambers. All right? And then there was a discussion inside Hagerty's office. And then Harry Connick called Washington. All right? Okay? Now, what happened then is that the judge went ahead, reconvened the jury, all right, and Alcock asked Kennedy if prior to his interview with Dean Andrews, had he been engaged in an inquiry into JFK's assassination? The answer was yes. All right. Alcock then was allowed to ask one follow-up question. Was Kennedy seeking Clay Bertrand in connection with his overall inquiry at that time? And Kennedy said that he was. All right?
And tell us the significance of Clay Bertrand. We've talked about
Bertrand, of course, is the guy that everybody was talking about, you know, as an alias for Clay Shaw. So if Kennedy was looking for this guy prior to his interview with Andrews, and that seems to be the meaning, because the questioning was very limited, very not nuanced, but that seems to be one of the meanings of Kennedy's testimony. That is very, 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 very interesting, which it implies that Regis Kennedy had information other than Andrews about the role of Clay Bertrand in the case.
A.K.A. Clay Shaw, of course.
Right. Yeah. Now, the Attorney General at this time, okay, because now we're talking about 1969, okay, after the election of 1968, the Attorney General at this time was John Mitchell, and he's the guy who severely limited, all right, the questioning of Kennedy. Now, later on, I found out through declassified documents that the FBI's chief of special investigations, William Brannigan, okay, he had done a review of the FBI's overall inquiry, okay, into the JFK case in 1967. And he stated that all the information Regis Kennedy uncovered had been forwarded to the Warren Commission, but some of them had been sealed at the request of certain commission members, all right? And McGeorge Bundy also, this, of course, was JFK's national security advisor, who was a friend of Alan Dulles. Parts of that report had been sealed because it pertained to information showing certain people were homosexuals, and this was deemed as not important to the investigation. Now, since the term homosexual was used in the plural, this almost has to be referring to Clay Shaw and Ferry, okay? And this reverts back to the information we had earlier, which we talked about, how Ramsey Clark had said in public that they had an investigation into Clay Shaw, and he had been cleared, okay, without realizing that the next follow-up question would be, well, why were you investigating Clay Shaw in the first place back in 1963? All right? So this is all very, very fascinating, okay? You know, and although clearly the trial was meant to bury Garrison, things like this, all right, really tell us how close he was to the actual facts of what were happening, all right, and that the FBI had tried to cover up.
A couple of points very quickly, Jim. We should note that Ramsey Clark, who helped to torpedo Garrison's investigation, was LBJ's attorney general, then Nixon, and the connections between the JFK assassination and Watergate could not be exaggerated. I've done many shows about those. We've alluded to that. Then Nixon has John Mitchell as his attorney general. Nixon, in Dallas, Texas, on November 22nd of 63, tells the FBI that the only time he was in Dallas was 2 days before the assassination. That's a lie. And then John Mitchell basically butchers Regis Kennedy's potential testimony. I also think it's worth noting in passing that even though the institutions like CIA and FBI behaved in an altogether criminal and conspiratorial fashion, there are many individual operatives of both institutions who didn't. Gary, we mentioned, I think it was Gary Goldhill. We didn't mention him, but you write about him in an earlier, is it Gary Underhill, the fellow who...
Gary Underhill, yes.
Gary Underhill, who said he knew a CIA guy who... knew about the assassination, then wound up with his allegedly committing suicide. And Regis Kennedy obviously was in a position to shed some serious light on the assassination, but John Mitchell sealed his lips. I would note that Regis Kennedy passed away, like so many people did, on the eve of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, quote, investigation, unquote. We should perhaps put that in quotes.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
So, again, we have two attorneys general, one under LBJ, one under Richard Nixon, interceding to torpedo Garrison's investigation, and I think... I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that Regis Kennedy was something of an interdicted hero, perhaps, in this.
Yeah, well, like I said, he probably had a lot of information that he could have offered, but he was ended up being kind of a political football, okay, you know, in this whole, you know, duel at the trial. I mean, can you imagine that kind of intervention in a state trial from the federal government? I mean, it's just, it's very, very bizarre. But that shows you the ends which Washington will go to in order to go ahead and cover up what was really going on in New Orleans at the time. And by the way, I should add, the Justice Department, that wasn't all they did in this trial. Because one of the most, probably, I believe, the most important testimony that was revealed down in New Orleans at the trial of Clay Shaw was from Dr. Pierre Fink, all right, because Fink had been called by Shaw's attorneys, if you can believe it, all right.
Tell us who he was.
Okay, Pierre Fink was one of the three autopsy doctors who did the forensic examination of Kennedy's body that night when it flew in from Dallas, all right, into Bethesda, all right. He was also, by the way, I should add, he was the one guy who would actually qualify as being a forensic pathologist of the three, the other two being Thornton Boswell and Jim Humes, because they were really more administrators than they were practicing forensic pathologists. Fink was the best qualified of the three, all right? So he took the stand, and he testified to what the official story was, you know, that there were two shots from behind Okay, one that went through Kennedy's back became the magic bullet, and one to the head, okay, that came in at the base of the skull and left through the, you know, above and to the right of the right ear. All right, that was a fatal shot. Well, they didn't know that in the intervening years between 1964 and 1969, there had been some very intelligent and experienced people who had gone through the volumes of the Warren Commission. Okay, one of them being a Philadelphia lawyer by the name of Vincent Salandria. All right, and Salandria had prepared an article for Liberation Magazine that was published in 1965. It was a two-part article, and it examined this basic point that to him, the medical evidence in this case didn't make any sense at all. All right, and so he was a friend of Jim Garrison's, and he went ahead and helped the DA prepare this part of the examination, which was conducted specifically by a guy named Al Oser. Al Oser. And Oser got Fink in a vise. And Garrison and Oser didn't realize what was really happening here. I don't think anybody did, because nobody knew the depth of the cover-up about the medical evidence in the JFK case.
Jim, we should mention that Pierre Fink was actually a colonel in the U.S. Army, because that bears directly on what you're saying.
I think he was actually in the Navy.
Was he in the
Okay.
He was an officer. I thought he was an Army colonel, but I may be wrong. I'd have to go back and check that. Okay. Anyway, he was a military officer and thereby had to obey orders.
Yes. Right, correct. All right. What happened is that you're right, he was U.S. Army, excuse me.
Yeah, that's
that was a mistake.
Yep.
Okay, it was Humes that was in the Navy.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, what happened is that Oser began to ask him a lot of very pointed questions. All right. And what happened is that since Fink was under oath, it wasn't very easy for him to lie his way out of these questions, like, for example, would have easily been done with the Warren Commission. Okay, and unlike Arlen Specter, Oser and Garrison were not supporting the cover-up, as Specter was for the Warren Commission. All right, and so Oser asked him some rather interesting questions. All right, he said a very simple question: why didn't you call the Dallas doctors that night? Okay, and Fink said, well, I wasn't running the show. And he said, well, Oser said, well, who was running the show? And he said he thought Humes was in charge. And Oser asked him, was that really the case? And Fink replied and said, well, at one point during the proceedings, Humes called out, who's in charge here? And he heard an Army general reply, I am. And then Fink added, you must understand that in those circumstances, there were law enforcement officials, military people with various ranks, and here's the killer quote, you have to coordinate the operations according to directions. This was a bombastic statement for Fink to make, okay? Because he's actually saying there that what they were doing was being coordinated by the military brass that was in the room. And there was a heck of a lot of military brass in the room that night. There were upwards of over 30 people in the room that night witnessing this autopsy. Okay, which, you know, there should have been at the most, you know, the three pathologists, their assistants, and the Kennedy family, which was up on the 15th floor, I think. So how all those guys, why, what they were doing there and why is a mystery that has never really been solved. Okay? And then when Fink stated that there were all these people there, all right, Oster asked him, did you feel you had to take orders from this army general? And Fink got him himself into more trouble and now said, no, because there were others. There were admirals. And when you are a lieutenant colonel in the army, you just follow orders. All right? He then said that at the end of the procedure, they were sworn to secrecy. Now, this kind of stuff that Fink was saying, all right, and the very, very important statement he made later as to why he did not dissect Kennedy's back wound. All right, now, look, I guess I should preface that a little.
Well, wasn't that actually the neck wound that he wouldn't dissect?
Well, okay, well, that's an interesting question itself.
Okay.
See, the magic bullet says that if you listen to the Warren Report, the revised version, which Gerald Ford wrote, the bullet from the back came in at the base of the neck, and they said it exited the front of the neck, okay? And then it went on and hit Conley, made a total of something like 7 wounds and 2 people, smashing 2 bones, okay? And emerged relatively unscathed if you believe the Warren Commission, it was on Connolly's stretcher at Parkland Hospital.
Harold Weisberg observed that this was the only inanimate object in all of physical history to generate independent reverse momentum. And it was somehow the bullet worked itself out of Conley's thigh. That had never happened in the known physical universe before.
Right.
A stationary object generating its own independent momentum. Obviously, that was the way Weisberg phrased it. A more colloquial way of putting it, the official version is absolute BS.
Right. Right, you're correct. Now, Fink was asked by Oser, why did you not dissect the track of that wound? Now, when you dissect the track of a wound, what that means is you carve out the bullet path, okay, because you want to find out two things. You want to find out directionality, that is, from where did the bullet enter, and you want to find out if it transited all the way. Was it a through-and-through wound? And this would have been the most direct way to find out those two mysteries that everybody has been talking about for the last over 50 years. Did the wound enter from the front or the back, and did it go all the way through the body? So Oser asked him the question, why didn't you dissect the wound? And in one of the most bizarre colloquies you're ever going to read, Fink did everything he could not to answer that question. All right?
How many times did Oser have to ask him that
Oser
question?
Oser had to ask him the question 8 times.
And this is on the stand.
Right. And finally, Oser had to ask the judge to intervene. Okay? Can you please direct the witness to answer that question, okay? And finally, he said that Humes was directed not to dissect the wound, all right? So in other words, somebody in the room, in that military brass, stopped him from doing that fundamental autopsy practice. Now, this, of course, raises all kinds of questions, you know. For instance, why? I mean, did somebody in that room already know why it was so desperate not to go ahead and dissect that wound track? That's mind-boggling, if it's true. It's mind-boggling that somebody would know that quickly that this was going to be a fundamental tenet of the cover-up. Because understand, you're talking about 8 to 11 at night Eastern Standard Time.
On November 22nd, 1963.
Yeah, right. Yes. So in other words, one day has not even elapsed yet.
About 10 hours.
Yeah. How on earth could somebody know that quickly, you know?
But briefly, Jim, let me recap. This is on the stand, and Colonel Pierre Fink testifies that an unnamed superior officer, apparently an Army general, ordered him not to dissect the wound track. And in Fink's defense, he certainly knew what the hell was happening, and I don't think he wanted to end up like an awful lot of other people, or have his family end up. I think he knew what was going on, and certainly by the time of the Clayshaw trial. And, you know, he was bowing before the inevitable, you know. And it is, you know, people say, man, I don't believe it was conspiracy. That basically is proof under oath of a conspiracy, because if an Army general is ordering a lieutenant colonel not to dissect a wound, he is interdicting the lawful investigation of the murder by precluding a key evidentiary procedure. And this is under oath on the stand during the Clayshaw trial. It is proof of a conspiracy. It also, as you've noted, this suggests very strongly that whoever that unnamed general was knew the significance of that.
Right. Now, this gets even worse because, as I said, Washington was monitoring the trial in real time. Okay? And so the word gets back to the Justice Department that Fink is revealing way too much on the stand. The exact words by Carl Belcher were, he's lousing everything up. And so he's endangering the cover-up, of course. That's what that means. And so he called in Thornton Boswell, who was another one of the pathologists who did the autopsy on JFK. And he was called in by Belcher to report to New Orleans, gave him a plane ticket, reserved a hotel room for him, and Harry Connick, who's coordinating the cover-up for the Justice Department, has the room decked out for him and the testimony of Pierre Fink on his desk when he arrives there. So in other words, they were going to use Boswell to discredit Fink. Okay? Do you believe this?
Sure.
What was
Harry Connick's official position, by the way, Jim? He was there, what was it, for the New Orleans court or DA, or what was his exact position and title?
Well, he wasn't there for Garrison. He was obviously there for Shaw's defense.
Right, right. But I'm just wondering what his official position was. Was he I've never been clear on that. What exactly?
He was a defense witness.
Okay.
He was
going to
be when Jeremy Gunn at the ARB, asked him that question, he goes, "Didn't it strike you as being odd that the federal government was going to go in and use you as a witness against Pierre Fink in what was really a local trial?" And Thornton Boswell said, "Well, everybody knew the Justice Department was backing up Clay Shaw's lawyers." Okay, so so that's how we explained it. But at the last minute, I guess the Justice Department decided not to do it. And Gary Aguilar, who's an expert on the medical evidence, said that it was probably because Fink really was a forensic pathologist. He was a practicing forensic pathologist at the time. Whereas Boswell and Humes were really what they called clinical pathologists. They were running an administrative office at that time.
Right.
So you would have had the spectacle of a guy who had more practicing expertise, Fink, trying to be discredited by a guy who nobody can find any evidence he ever did a formal autopsy in the last 10 years. Okay?
All righty.
So that was probably the reason they backed out of that. But see, Garrison and Oser did not realize what they were stepping in the middle of here. This was a massive cover-up of the medical evidence that had begun at least in 1965, okay, and it was continuing all the way up to the Clay Shaw trial, all right, because this, they were scratching the surface. You know, the weakest part of the official story. Originally, it was supposed to have been the strongest part of the official story. Okay, but as time went on, and more holes were punched in it, and more people talked, and more documents were declassified, it has now become, you know, the weakest part of the official story. You know, the medical autopsy of John F. Kennedy. All right? And Garrison was just... See, this should have all been... I think I've said that testimony should have been on the front pages of every major newspaper in America. It should have led the nightly news. Okay, NBC, back then, of course, there were only three stations, you know, NBC, ABC, and CBS. Okay, but that's the kind of gravity that testimony should have had applied to it, you know? But because of what we know was happening there, how Phelan was manipulating the press, you know, in his rented house down there, you know, that and the Zapruder film were all covered up. You know, Garrison actually showed the Zapruder film. He was the first guy to actually show it to an audience of public people, all right? And the jury was so fascinated by it, they asked it to be run 9 times. You know, so between the Zapruder film, which of course shows Kennedy being rocketed backwards, you know, and to his left with such force that he bounces off the back seat, all right, that, you know, and this stuff, then Garrison was doing a pretty good job blowing up the cover up.
Yep. By the way, a couple of quick points I'd like to interject in our second interview last week for the record 1047. We discussed how Ramsey Clark helped to stymie Jim Garrison's investigation by frustrating Garrison's attempts at getting the autopsy photographs. I would also note, and although you don't mention it, that I recall Jim in Destiny Betrayed. I interviewed, almost more than 20 years ago, a former Green Beret named Dan Marvin, who was recruited to kill a Navy Commander Pritzker, whom he was told was a traitor, was giving information to the Soviets. It turned out he was involved with the taking of the autopsy photographs and was questioning the official version, and eventually Dan Marvin declined the contract and then almost got sick. He was watching a TV show, I think it was called Who Killed Kennedy, and noted that Commander Pritzker was eventually shot to death, an alleged suicide but used the wrong hand, and got sick to his stomach.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
There is a glossy magazine called Cigar Aficionado, which shows people like, you know, Danny DeVito or Arnold Schwarzenegger or various people who enjoy cigars. There was apparently a Cigar Aficionado present at the autopsy. Tell us about that.
Okay. This is very interesting. I talked to a person who was actually in the autopsy room that night, a guy named Paul O'Connor, or he was an assistant there, and he said that as the autopsy was proceeding, Humes called him over and said, "You see that guy back there? He's smoking a cigar. Do you mind going over there and telling him to put it out?" And so O'Connor walks over, approaches the man, gets within a few feet of him, and he realizes that he's face-to-face with Curtis LeMay, the famous Air Force general, Okay.
And chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force at the time.
Right. And so he goes back to Humes and says, I can't. It's Curtis LeMay. All right. Now, I didn't know what to make of that story. You know, when you only have one witness telling you this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it later came out that on the Air Force One tapes, there are reports in the unexpurgated version of LeMay flying in from Michigan, okay, that day to Washington. All right? So clearly, what else would he be doing? Well, he must be cutting short his vacation for then to come into Washington and to be at the autopsy. All right? Now, why? See, this is how bad the Warren Commission was. Obviously, when you have this kind of testimony, which they never got because they never interviewed O'Connor and they never got the completely unexpurgated version of the tapes, you never got to question him about Mr. LeMay. Why would you be flying in from Michigan to Washington that day, smoking a cigar, while President Kennedy's autopsy was going on? You know?
Sure. But he probably remarked that getting real Cuban cigars from Fidel Castro, that was the only way he could do that. You know? I mean, it's a bad joke, but later on when we talk about the House Select Committee on Assassinations, they came across some remarkable information that specifically Earl Warren and company on the Warren Commission were specifically charged with covering things up, not investigating. We'll talk about that when we get to the House Select Committee. We made reference to the autopsy evidence and the Zapruder film. The Zapruder film itself, Jim, as you mentioned it, if you would perhaps develop that a little more for us, figured prominently in the trial of Clay Shaw. I wonder if you'd go into that a little more for us.
All right. Garrison had to go ahead and subpoena Time Life to get the Zapruder film because he had petitioned the court that in order to show that there was a conspiracy and that Shaw was part of it, he had to prove the Warren Commission was wrong. All right? And so that's what he did. One of the pieces of evidence that he used, okay, was the famous film, 8mm film taken by Abraham Zapruder in Dealey Plaza that day. He was up on a pedestal, okay, and with his secretary, Carolyn Sitzman, reminded him to go home and get his camera. Rather, he went back to his place of work. I think it was a dress shop. All right, and so he got his 8mm camera, came down to Dealey Plaza, and stood on top of this pedestal and took what is clearly the best film of the actual assassination. That film shows that as Kennedy comes out from behind the Stemmons Freeway sign, he's clearly been hit, all right, starting to lean forward, puts his hands up to either his shoulders or his neck, okay. Jackie begins to react. She begins to cringe in horror, realizing something's gone wrong. And he reportedly said, I've been hit. And then comes the fatal shot from which everybody, I think, who watches that film, from the front. And that shot hits him with such force that it jerks his whole body backwards, okay? And he almost bounces off the back seat of the car as his head explodes in tissue and blood rising up into the air, all right? And then Jackie Kennedy panics. She sees that part of his skull is falling out the back of the trunk of the car. She retrieves that piece of the skull, and then Clint Hill, who's the only Secret Service man to react at all, which is amazing, he runs up onto the back of the trunk of the car, jumps up on it, and then goes into the back seat covering Jackie and JFK, who's fallen over. She later gave that material that she retrieved off the trunk of the car to one of the doctors at Parkland Hospital. So that's what the Zapruder film shows. And as I said, this was the first time it had ever been seen in public, because prior to this, if you wanted to see it, you had to go to the National Archives for a private screening. You know, maybe two or three people would be able to see it. But now, for the first time, you actually had literally scores of people, all right, who actually saw this film. And the jury was very much impacted by it, stunned. They wanted to see it over and over. And so that night, James Phelan knew that he had a job to do. Okay?
James Phelan, by the way, being one of the intelligence-connected media hit people who were not only discrediting Garrison publicly, but actually working directly with Clay Saw's counsel. Go ahead, Jim.
Right. So once everybody was there, once all the reporters were there, all right, he brought out his chalkboard, and probably for the first time, mapped out the jet effect. This was how he explained Kennedy's head rocketing backwards in the car if Oswald was firing from behind. Okay, and the jet effect, I don't want to go into all the absurdity of it, but essentially he says that the blood and tissue escaping from the front of Kennedy's head had such an incredible force that it knocked Kennedy backwards. you believe that?
Well, you mentioned
I
this
have
last
some
week.
A bridge in Arizona that I want to sell to you. Okay.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing that was going on as these momentous revelations, okay, were being unfolded during the trial in New Orleans.
Parenthetically, Jim, I don't know whether off the top of my head whether it was the House Select Committee on Assassinations or the pillorying of Oliver Stone's JFK film, but an employee of the Lawrence Livermore National Weapons Laboratory came forward and said, yep, it was a jet effect. That's why Kennedy's head was rocketed backward. And there is a this info website dedicated to supporting the Warren Report, run by a guy named Kenneth A. Ron. And he also did his postgraduate work at the Lawrence Livermore National Weapons Laboratory, as well as the Max Planck Institute in Germany. So it looks like officialdom has been marshaled from within the national security establishment to back up Phelan's just stunning, you know, the jet effect. I mean, anyone who knows anything about forensics or gunshot, it is so obvious that Kennedy, the fatal headshot came from the front and to Kennedy's right. I mean, there is no way a bullet from behind could have produced a wound like that and the physical reaction of Kennedy's body. But, you know, the Phelan, again, one of the media hit people, and he testifies about this on the stand in New Orleans on behalf of Clay Shaw's defense.
Right. He was called to the stand by Shaw's lawyers about his interview with Perry Russo, in which he stated that Russo did not mention anything about Bertrand, okay, in Baton Rouge, which, of course, ended up being false, okay, because I found Matt Herron, who was there that day, and he said, yes, he did say that he did, all right, mention Clay Shaw at that time, or Bertrand. He knew him by Bertrand. So this is the kind of stuff that you had going on in New Orleans, and nobody knew about it because it was all submerged. It was all secret. It was all kept, as they say, classified information. You know, we the American public couldn't know about it on the grounds of what would they term national security. What their idea of national security, of course, I call censorship. Yeah. All right, it's to cover up their own misdeeds. There's nothing to do with national security. at all, period.
The synthesis of media intelligence infiltrators in the garrison's investigation and Shaw's defense team. You also wrote about how James Phelan at one point tried to negate Clay Shaw's presence in Clinton, Louisiana, by saying that was actually Guy Bannister.
Right, and correct. He also did try and say that. And when Alcock asked him, well, did you ever meet Bannister? And he says, no. Well, how do you know what he looked like? Well, he was described to me by Walter Sheridan. Okay.
The threshold as to who Walter Sheridan was.
Right. He was the producer of the NBC hit piece on Jim Garrison and worked for the NSA prior to that and the FBI.
And ONI.
Right, now, yep. The reason Bannister could not be Shaw is because Bannister was about 5'9 and a half. Clay Shaw was extremely tall. He was 6'4". So how anybody, you couldn't mistake one for the other. And in fact, one of the witnesses up there said that he saw Shaw coming out of a grocery store there, and he described him as a very tall guy, over 6 feet tall, with white hair, who reminded him of a movie actor, and it ended up being Jeff Chandler. Remember, Jeff Chandler used to be a movie star back in the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and you would have to say, well, yeah, he did a little bit. I don't know how anybody could mistake Bannister for Jeff Chandler. Okay, but all right. So it was impossible for Bannister. Phelan was just simply trying to cover up for Clay Shaw, which is what he did the entire time that he was in New Orleans. Okay, now I should add, of course, that I don't know why you need to rent a house if you're only going to testify on the stand for one day in New Orleans. Okay? So who rented that house for Phelan? Who supplied those refreshments, the drinks and the snacks, et cetera? Who supplied him with the jet effect? Those would have all been interesting questions to ask him.
He was sort of behaving like a maitre d' for the assembled reporters who were allegedly covering Garrison's case. And he basically had them over, and you know, they would have themselves a little soiree. And so his role is fundamental. Again, that synthesis I've alluded to so many times.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
In our previous interview, Jim, you mentioned Judge Hagerty and Aloysius Habeckhorst. Once again, the Clay Shaw, Clay Bertrand dynamic is important. Review that for us briefly.
Yes. Habeckhorst was the booking officer the night that Garrison had Shaw indicted. And he fingerprinted Shaw and asked him, do you use any aliases? And Shaw, evidently upset by what's going on, said Clay Bertrand. And Habeckhorst wrote this down. You know, I think on two separate forms, all right? And the next day when he was watching television, a reporter came on local TV and explained the significance of the Bertrand alias, and Habeckhorst jumped up and said to his wife, that's what he told me, all right? And so he went ahead and he told Garrison about this, and he was going to be one of Garrison's witnesses at the trial, all right? But in a kind of inexplicable move, the judge, Hagerty, cleared the courtroom, got the jury into chambers, and said, I don't believe Habeckhorst, and I'm not going to let him testify at the trial. Now, that combined with the Spiesel testimony were the two fatal things at the trial for Garrison. I don't think did we talk about Spiesel?
We mentioned that last week. This is the guy who had his daughter fingerprinted so that when she came back from college, he could be sure it was still his daughter. And I've forgotten which member of, I think it was William Gervich, who worked with one of the media hatchet people and Shaw's defense team to handle that one. But again, that synthesis to which I've alluded so many times in my last couple of interviews was quite remarkable. Jim, I'm unclear Harry Connick was really important, and we're going to get to a term I'll coin here, the Connick tonic to destroy Garrison's investigation future our talk probably next week about what happened after the trial itself. But I'm unclear as to what Harry Connick's exact cachet was at the trial. Was he?
He was a local Justice Department representative.
Okay, so
the Justice Department has attorneys throughout the country,
okay,
that do federal cases. And that's what his job was at the time.
So
that's
attorney.
Why he right. was, he ended up essentially being the liaison between Washington and the Clay Shaw trial. Okay, he was their representative, keeping them alerted to everything that's going on during that trial. That's why he was there.
And very, very interesting. Very quickly, we've got about 10 minutes left. Can you give us a real quick encapsulation of Dean Andrews' changed testimony?
Okay, Dean Andrews, of course, is the local attorney who said that this guy named Bertrand had called him up and wanted him to go to Dallas to defend Lee Harvey Oswald. Okay, I think that was either on the 23rd or the 24th, all right? And what happened is he said to various people who interviewed him that no matter what, he could not reveal who this guy really was, since there was no Clay Bertrand in New Orleans, all right? And he made it very clear that his life would be in physical danger if he did so, all right? He said this to Mark Lane, he said it to Garrison, he told it to Anthony Summers, all right? And so, first, he said he didn't know who he was. Then, for the NBC special, he said he was a guy named Eugene Davis, okay? And it turned out, of course, that Eugene Davis did not use that alias at all, but I later found out that Andrews was trying to give us a hint because it turned out that Davis was kind of a pimp for Shaw. Okay? All right? And so then, at the trial of Clay Shaw, he now had a third story, and now he said he made the whole thing up. Okay? Now, what's interesting about that is that Garrison already indicted Andrews and convicted him for perjury. But since the perjury case was on appeal at the time, he was still allowed to testify at the trial. And he said, of course, he made the whole thing up to the jury, all right, which is another setback for Garrison at the trial, all right.
And eventually Garrison got Dean Andrews convicted of perjury.
Yes.
So
yes.
He was unsuccessful. We're going to talk in our next pair of interviews about what happened with Clay Shaw's perjury trial and some of the things that happened afterward. Something of a bridge, Jim. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left. Tell us about Harry Connick. Richard Helms, in a memo, emphasized the importance of seeing to it that Garrison was neutralized before, during, and after the Clay Shaw trial. Tell us about Harry Connick and his behavior after the trial. And you mentioned that no one had seen more of Garrison's actual files than you have, but yet only 40% of them were surviving. There may be a reason for that. Tell us about
Harry
Connick.
Yes, because what happened is that the CIA did everything they could to get Garrison out of office, all right, and to destroy his case, all right? And so what happened is that they ran Connick against Garrison twice, all right? The first time, Garrison managed to stave it off, but the second time he was defeated by a narrow margin. And the reason he was defeated is because the Justice Department had tried to frame him on these phony charges, all right, that somehow he was selling off cases, all right, through a guy named Pershing Gervais, who was a friend of Garrison's, all right. It ended up that at the trial, the case was exploded, because Gervais all but admitted that the Justice Department got him out of the country because they didn't want him to be questioned before the trial because they knew that his testimony was wafer thin and would be exposed, okay, under cross-examination. Well, what happened is that that weakened Garrison to a, even though he won, that Connick got into office, and Connick began going ahead, whatever was left over from the Clay Shaw case, Connick had literally sent to the incinerator. Okay, because how do we know this? Because one of the people who was working with him at the time, a private investigator named Gary Raymond, actually testified to that effect. And it created a big hubbub in both the local media down there and the national media. Now, between what Connick did and between what people like Bill Boxley did, which was stealing files out of his office, and also I found out later that a friend of Garrison's who had Garrison had used to store some of his file cabinets in his garage, those were stolen. Okay? So I estimate that what we have today is probably about 40% of what Garrison's files really were, between what happened with Connick, what happened with this stealing them out of the garage, and between what happened with Boxley stealing files out of Garrison's office while he was working there. I'd say we have about 40% of what Garrison really had. Now, what's amazing is that I'm one of the very few people that's been allowed to go through this stuff and to be able to write a book like this based on that. You could imagine how good the book would have been if I would have had everything, okay,
well,
which
if,
I didn't have.
If what you and using the resources of the ARRB and the HSCA were able to come up with what you came up with, and it is magnificent with a capital M. Yeah, it would be celestial if you could have access to all the other 60%. It's interesting to speculate. We'll never know what was in that other 60% of the files. Next week, Jim, in our first interview, I'd like to talk about some of the after. We've touched on it here, but what happened to Jim Garrison afterward, because Helms, as we've indicated, in that memo basically mandated that it was important to neutralize Garrison's effect after the trial as well. You have written JFK, The Evidence Today, in addition to Destiny Betrayed, which has been the focal point of this massive series of interviews and ongoing, too. And also today is Martin Luther King's actual birthday. The holiday will be observed on Monday, the 21st of January. Tell us about the books, where they can order them. Tell us about your website and about Black Op Radio.
Yes. I run a website on all four major assassinations of the 60s. That is JFK, RFK, King, and Malcolm X, and that's called KennedysandKing.com. If you go to that website, you'll see a couple of ads for my latest two books, which are The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, and this book that we've been discussing, Destiny Betrayed, the second edition. You can go ahead and buy the books there. All right, and I also am a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's radio show out of Vancouver, Canada, called Black Op Radio.
Indeed. So there are places that people who would like to follow up on this can go to do just that. And we're right near the end of the program, Jim. I want to, we still got some weeks to go, so the march goes on. Don't set your 80-pound backpack down yet. We're going to have a quick hit from the canteens, maybe some sea rations, and then we're going to go marching on. But I want to thank you for indulging my desire to do this sort of, you know, using a trial metaphor, gavel-to-gavel coverage of the JFK assassination. There's so much more that even isn't in your book, and that's not the fine fault. People may be wondering, why in hell is Jane spending all of this time on the JFK assassination? He's spoken about it before, blah, blah, blah. This is a really good in vitro observation post as to how things work in this country and the dimension and depth of the lying. And as I said, that all-important synthesis that we've spoken about is maybe the most important part of your book for a contemporary audience. We will talk more about this, however, in future interviews, because this concludes For the Record program number 1049, interview number 18 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. For Jim DiEugenio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening. By the way, this has been recorded on January 15th of the year 2019. Thanks for listening.